From Vancouver, British Columbia, Canada, this is the New Media BC Podcast. Coming up on this edition, I'll talk with Mark Pesching. His pioneering work in virtual reality modeling set the stage for modern 3D animation. He's an inventor, a software engineer, and a filmmaker. And now he combines those passions, teaching at a film and new media center in Sydney, Australia.
It's not about infrastructure anymore. It's about interface now. That's what this revolution is all about. That's what I'm teaching my design students. Because I don't only work with the filmmakers, but I have a cadre of students who specifically work on these issues. We can pretty much do anything we want now in the domain of electronic communication.
A fascinating discussion with Mark Pesching coming up. Also, a guy who's been making video games pretty much since the beginning. Kelly Zamak is the new Chief Operating Officer at Radical Entertainment. We talk about his passion for people, the resurgence of convergence, and the state of the video game industry.
When you think about the size of the industry and you look at it from sheer dollars, you know, we're in excess of $10 billion in annualized revenues. Are we growing? There's no doubt. And I think that's indicative by just looking around at the competition here in Vancouver, but also throughout North America, throughout Europe, throughout Asia, that this expansion of the video game industry continues to rise.
Kelly Zamak, coming up. And we'll have a look at what's coming up in the future for NMBC, because
we have the reputation of throwing really good parties, which we don't have any plans to lose that reputation in the future.
We'll talk about the organization and where BC's headed with Linda Brown of New Media BC. That's all coming up.
Save humanity from total destruction.
Woohoo!
It's up to Homer Simpson and family to save the world from a diabolical plot as they run and drive to unravel the conspiracy.
Black Finch!
Critics call it the best Simpsons game ever.
Get the light, dudes.
The Simpsons Hit and Run, rated T for Teen.
I am evil Homer.
That's from the trailer to The Simpsons Hit and Run, one of Radical Entertainment's hit video games. And I'm here at Radical in Vancouver, sitting with Kelly Zamak. He's been a major force in the video game business for 20 years. Kelly's name first appeared on the credits of Ghostbusters, a game created in 1986, based on the movie by the same name. Since then, he's had a hand in dozens of award-winning and top-selling games, titles like MechWarrior, Counter-Strike, Lord of the Rings. If you have a video game in your house, chances are you'll find Kelly's name on the side of the box. He's also worked for companies like Hasbro, Acclaim, Activision, and Panasonic. Since last July, Kelly's been the Chief Operating Officer and Senior Vice President for Product Development here at Radical. Kelly, thanks for being on the podcast.
My pleasure.
Radical has a long history in Vancouver, first as an independent and now part of Vivendi Universal. How did you first encounter Radical?
When I was in Washington State, I was working with Radical on a number of projects through our Sierra studio. And that relationship was, you know, they've always had a track record of incredible quality, working there kind of through the various changes that the industry goes through. We had a chance to work together closely in that capacity, and so that's where I knew of them. I, of course, knew of them from their games, you know, Simpsons Road Rage, the Simpsons Hit and Run title. So I had known that for them from a gamer's perspective, but that was my first chance to actually work with them from a business perspective.
And when you came over in July, was that a big move for you to come up from Washington State to relocate in Vancouver with a company that obviously has a lot of similar interests as in terms of the kind of products that it's been making as you've had in your past?
Yeah, it was a big move. It was not in the plan. My wife and I joke about it quite a bit that I was going to start my own business. I had my business plan in place and was getting ready to go into a consulting thing. And so then this opportunity kind of came up, and I came up here and met with Ian and met with the staff. And it was like, nah, I'm doing this out of courtesy. I feel like I'm doing this out of, you know, things. I walked home. I got home, walked in the door. My wife looked at me, and she just looked at my face. She goes, so when are we moving? So it was an exciting, really for me, it was an exciting thing. And it was a complete shift mentally from doing my own thing, doing my own business, to, wow, stepping back into another studio operation.
Yeah. The Ian you mentioned is Ian Wilkinson, who's the president of Radical and one of the founders. Hard guy to say no to, isn't he?
He is. He's, you know, he's... right off the bat, we had a good sync, good level of communication. You know, we're both very direct, very outgoing individuals, and that I think that relationship clicked from the very early.
How would you characterize the health of the game industry now? We keep hearing how big it is, and even in Vancouver, even though it's such a big hub here, we don't really understand quite the size of the game business in the world today.
I mean, when you think about size of the industry and you look at it from sheer dollars, you know, we're in excess of $10 billion in annualized revenues. It's a difficult task to say where we're going. Are we growing? There's no doubt, and I think that's indicative by just looking around at the competition here in Vancouver, but also throughout North America, throughout Europe, throughout Asia, that this expansion of the video game industry continues to rise. The challenge is it's growing from two separate views. It's growing from the fact that it takes more people to do a project in today's business than it did in the past. In 1985, when I started, there were basically three people assigned to a project. It lasted 3 months. You know, in the early days, we actually put it in the cellophane plastic bag, Ziploc bags, and we would sell it, you know, out of a plastic bag with a white label sticker. So we've gone from this very grunt level, guerrilla level business to there are over 100 people assigned to these projects. They last for 36 months in development. The entire world changes over a duration of a product, and we'll spend millions creating them. So that is the first aspect of growth, and that brings people into the industry, and it gives us an opportunity to bring in multiple levels of people into the industry. We're always looking for those experienced jocks. We're always looking for the top of the line. But given this change in the industry as it continues to expand, that also allows us to bring some of the less experienced people into the industry, some of the college grads coming in who have a passion for getting into the industry and find a place for them. The other area that it's expanding is really going to be in a growing market segment, and this is where we're seeing a lot of expansion. The casual gaming market has talked a lot about. The women in the gaming industry has talked a lot about. We're trying to find a way to capitalize on these expanding markets. And online certainly is one of that. Mobile is part of that. Handheld is a big chunk of that. All of these various medias that are growing, we're trying to find a way to capitalize, not just us, VUG Radical, but the industry as a whole. And part of it is remaining flexible enough to respond to the changes, but also having some foresight and placing some bets and taking some risks that it's going to be there when you're ready. And that's that balancing act. It's, you know, knowing and investing in what you already know is a viable, strong business, and then experimenting with some new opportunities as they come up. The handheld market is one of those expansive markets right now. It's just kind of blowing out. We've got the PSP that recently was released. You've got the Nintendo DS that's doing phenomenally well. Nintendo GBA continues to sell well. We've got some new players into the marketplace. But one of the things that distinguishes these is the interactivity both with other players from those platforms, and now the interactivity of those platforms to the console and to the PC. And it's expanding the world. And you will see in the coming days, in the coming years, where you're playing a product on your handheld, and you sign out, and you go home and you sit at your PC or you sit at your console, and you're playing the same game. And the impact that you had on your handheld affects how your game is played on the console. And it's this interactivity. We're dealing with what I call that digital leisure time, and I have to admit I stole that from somebody. I don't remember where I heard it. But that digital leisure time where we have DVD, we have internet, console gaming, PC gaming, every active of passive entertainment, movies, videos, just radio, all of those are that digital leisure time. And what we're looking for is to slice a piece of that digital leisure time to our business. And if they spend time on it, they'll spend money on it. And that's really what everyone is fighting for. And that scary word, convergence, is happening around us. And in fact, it's become passé because it's happening so aggressively that all of these medias will eventually interact in a way that is new and different and exciting. And there's room for all of these medias within that. It's not a replacement. It's this cool and a very exciting merge.
Convergence got a bad name partly because of the dot-com bust,
yeah.
partly because a lot of large media companies just threw money at Convergence without really a plan, and that kind of blew up. But as you say, it really has happened. It almost is passé. We're starting to see the movement of data from your computer to your MP3 player, whether it's an iPod or whatever, and that now is moving into the car. We're getting satellite radio in Canada a little later than the US, but you know, those technologies are all now just part of our everyday life. So convergence is here. I guess the trick is how we're going to move from the phone to the PSP to the desktop. And I think what you're talking about is a vision for the future where I have some identity that follows me around with those devices.
And part of the challenge will be, what do you as a consumer want? And us being smart enough to figure that out before somebody else gets there. And that's where that emerging opportunity comes from. I mean, there's always going to be a sit in front of the TV gaming mindset. And we're seeing, you know, statistics at 43 years old. And I started gaming in, well, frankly, my high school years because there wasn't a whole lot out there. I remember my dad brought Pong home. And I thought, wow, this is so cool. My parents were worried, you know, sit in front of the computer for hours playing these games. What's he doing? I don't know what he's doing. You know, and that... We're finding that as gamers start in these younger years, they continue to game up into their 40s. And it's not something that falls off. It changes. And so that's where those demographics come into play. But each one of those is a unique market opportunity, and finding out what those consumers want and their changing expectations, and then meeting those expectations in a way that they go, wow, that's cool, or that's exciting, or that's just fun. That element that we magic fairy dust, where you can't define it, you can't write it down on a piece of paper, but when you feel it, you go, "Wow, yeah, that's right." And that excitement, that level of energy, is what we strive for. It's that magic fairy dust that you look for in every product. And that's our industry is unique in that it's that interaction. The consumer is part of the world.
A couple of areas that you're very passionate about. One of them being the culture of work in a game company. Radical has a fantastic reputation, both as a great place to work and attracting talent. What are the challenges in keeping that kind of a reputation going?
I think first and foremost, the challenge is the competitive nature of any environment where it always can look greener on the other side. And, you know, especially here in Vancouver, it's very competitive. We've got new companies coming in. We've got an 800-pound gorilla down the street. You know, we've got these large organizations. We've got these small organizations. And here we are as an organization that we say, you know, we have a cool culture. And you ask yourself, well, what does that mean? It means we have a group of people with an attitude that says they want to be here, they want to participate, but they need to feel like they have an impact. They need to see that their thoughts, their actions, their mindset, the things that they believe and the things that they work on have a real impact to the organization. And I think that's what makes us unique. We're a large organization, 250 people, but we're a small company, and we try to run that way. And my, you know, it was interesting, the VUG acquisition, a major transition for the studio. I was asked to come in, and the very first thing that I was asked to do is don't let the culture get damaged, eroded. The culture's not a thing. It's a living entity. It's derived by the people in the organization. A couple of weeks ago, I was at a dinner, and I was sitting across from somebody, and the guy says, so what makes your studio unique? And I said, you know, in my opinion, the most valuable resource, the most valuable thing we have is our people. Our people are who we are. They're what make us who we are. And so if I can find a way to create an environment where they truly want to be here and they're having fun, they'll work hard by themselves. I don't need to ask them to work hard. And he said across the table, he says, I've heard that so many times, but you actually sound like you believe it. And I do. I do believe it. It's never perfect. It's never utopian. It's always hard work. But it's a lot of fun. We make games for a living. My gosh, it's supposed to be fun. And I think that's part of it, as part of the culture. It's part of the organization that drive to be successful, to make something truly as great in the interactive world, in that entertainment business, and to have that build upon that and grow upon that. And, you know, we'll always be a different company tomorrow than we are today. But the unique opportunity is to allow the organization, the people of the organization, the staff, to participate in how that changes and evolves.
And you clearly love what you do, and obviously that has to rub off on folks.
I personally believe the one common trait behind a successful leader is energy. It's the energy you bring to your job. It's the passion you bring to the people around you. It's the leadership that you provide. It's the tools that you give them. Knowing full well in the end, I don't make a game. I clear roadblocks. If necessary, I stand in the roadway with a bazooka and blow it out of the way. But really what I do is I give them the opportunity to focus, and out of that mutual relationship, there comes that magic fairy dust that goes, wow, this is really cool. And I think you look on our projects this year and you look on our projects next year, and every product we're working on, it's like, wow, that's cool. You know, I hate to overuse the word, but we struggle to define a word that really describes what we do, because what we do is so unique.
The other thing I know that you've spoken about recently, and I know that you have, I don't know if passion is the right word, but a concern about it, and that's women in the game industry. Mm-hmm. Statistically, this company is like every other game company, really. Huge number, proportion of the staff are men.
Right.
And for a long time, the game buying public has been typically guys. How is that going to change over time, or what's it going to take for that to change over time?
The old school, that back in the old days, and having too many years in the industry, the old days were when dinosaurs roamed the earth, but it really was just a guy club. I mean, it was about a single target. You were shooting for that Atari 2600 player, which was always the male. We're seeing two trends in the industry right now that are changing the way we approach gaming. The first trend is more women are getting involved in traditional gaming. This is the first surprise. World of Warcraft from Blizzard, our sister studio, I think current stats around 40% of the online audience is female. And I mean, that's remarkable. In our industry, it's wow. You know, how do you go there? So that's the first trend. The second trend is actually creating games that appeal to that different audience. And although Radical has not been on the forefront of that, we do have examples. The CSI products that we did are clearly targeted to that audience, that female audience. And we think that that's an emerging opportunity and an emerging marketplace. The real effect that I see of both of these trends for the studio is an increase in the amount of women engineers, women artists, and women designers in the marketplace who will look at the gaming industry and go, oh, well, maybe that is a place I want to be. I don't, you know, not every game we do is a shooter. Not every game we do is a kids game. Not every game we do is a teen game. They'll be able to look at our industry and go, you know, there's a place for me within it, and there's an opportunity within it, where I feel that up until recently, they haven't felt the doors were open. And so we don't get a lot of female candidates. We don't get a lot of people applying for positions. And as much as I would love to see it, I know it's part of that transition, it's part of that trend. As they become gamers, they will want to be involved in creation of games. And we have to find that right blend and that right mix. And that's why I do believe you'll see an expansion in those disciplines in the industry as a whole, especially here at Radical, because we seek it out. That, you know, that there will always be a disconnect in men-women mindsets. It exists, just like there are in men-to-men mindsets and individuals. Those disconnects are not bad. Those disconnects are invaluable as we attempt to reach mass audiences, as we attempt to reach a product distribution that puts us in the hundreds of millions of eyes. And you can't do that focusing on an 18 to 35-year-old hormonally imbalanced male. You're just not going to get there.
Yeah, and I guess, too, part of it starts with the story, because, I mean, really, at the end of the day, every game starts with some narrative, some story or some quest or some job. And if you've got women involved in the company making the decisions about which of those to pursue, I guess the whole nature of those games then can change around that.
Absolutely. I mean, it's the collective complementary skills of the people involved that make an effective team. And, you know, we're looking for that. We're looking for that within the organization. I think everybody's looking for that.
I want to switch over to talk a little bit about the relationship between games and the movie industry now. Mm-hmm. You worked on lots and lots of games that were based on or related to motion pictures. But it seems to me that today, I'm not sure who's getting more of the benefit, whether the movies are actually getting more benefit from the game being spun off than the other way around.
It's truly mutual. It really is mutual. I'm back to that digital leisure time and the convergence, nasty word of convergence. they're in the consumer's mind, the promotional dollars that go behind a movie, and the visual representation and the imagery of that movie being tied to an interactive experience is profound. It's extremely powerful for the consumer. The how they envision it, you know, the Tolkien works. Whether you were a big fan of the movie or a big fan of the novels, having read those novels, the visions that are created in your mind, and then to have those come to life in the game, are just extremely powerful. So I truly believe that that's a symbiotic relationship. It's one that we struggle with because we struggle at completely different business models. We struggle at completely different investment models and completely different revenue models. And so each one of these, the way we create, the way those pieces have to come together, and I think you're seeing more of it. But you're seeing more of it as we stumble through it. It's not like we have a plan. We go A to B. It's, you know, oops, okay, well, don't do that one again. So we're learning as we go, and I think it will grow and it will mature, and you'll see more of it in the future. And I think it's truly a complementary relationship. They benefit from ours. We benefit from theirs. You're seeing game properties become movies, for good or for bad. You're seeing movie properties become games, for good or for bad. And what we really need are properties that are exploited across all these medias that are done well. And a great game will help a movie to a degree, but you know, it's not. A great movie will help a game to a degree, but if you got a great movie and a great game, yes, that's the magic. That's the magic.
It only makes sense that any great story or any great brand should spread out across as many devices as possible, because we're using different devices. All of us are now. Sort of leads me to ask you what devices you use in your personal life and your work life, and are they different?
I carry my BlackBerry with me all the time. I carry my PSP with me pretty religiously. I'm in the process of playing Untold Legends. Almost done with the game, so I got almost to the finish. And those are really the two primary devices. When I travel, obviously, I carry my laptop just for the convenience of having it available to me. At home, it's a slightly different scenario. We made the decision not to get cable, so we don't really watch television. Now, I have a 60-inch high-definition TV with surround sound, and my PlayStation and Xbox are hooked up to that, and so we do spend a lot of time gaming, multiplayer gaming, between my two daughters, my wife, and myself, and that was part of that entire experience. And in fact, it was my wife's idea to get the large television, because she was tired of trying to fit all four of us on a 36-inch screen. So that's pretty much at home. It's focused on our gaming as a family or gaming together. We don't do a lot of solo gaming in regards to that, but that's a different experience there than it is here. We don't use the portables too much at home.
Right. What can we look for from Radical this Christmas?
Yeah, we certainly have shipped. We shipped two of our key titles this year. We shipped Hulk Ultimate Destruction for the Xbox, PlayStation, and the GameCube. And we shipped Crash Tag Team Racing, also for Xbox, PlayStation 2, and the GameCube, and for PSP. For 06, we're currently focused predominantly on Scarface, which is a more mature rated title targeting for that adult gamer. Which certainly, I think industry stats that the average gamer is 26 years old. There's a real sweet spot for it there, and we're looking forward to that one. That one's going to be another big hit for us.
When are we going to see that one?
Be shipping in 06, but that's as much as I can say right now.
How many air miles a year are you flying?
I'm currently on track to cover over 100,000 this year. So
you're on the go all the time.
Yeah, too many miles.
Okay, thank you very much, Kelly. Great to have you on the podcast, and good luck.
Great, I appreciate the time.
Thanks.
All I have in this world is my balls and my word, and I don't break them for no one. Do you understand? Dinah's gone. We got to set our own mark and enforce it. We got to think big now. Me, I want what's coming to me. World.
I'm
buried
those cockroaches!
And everything in it.
Who put this thing to
death? Every dog has his day.
Another trailer from Radical Entertainment from the video game Scarface to be released next year. You know, I used to look a bit like Al Pacino when I was younger. People sometimes would mistake me for him on the street, really. You're listening to the New Media BC podcast. I'm Robert Wiemat. Still ahead, I'll be talking with Mark Pesce. If you're old school, you'll remember his name from the early days of virtual reality modeling. Mark's an author, filmmaker, artist, engineer, so actually very few things he isn't, and is currently a professor in Sydney, Australia. I'll talk to him on the phone. As I said, this podcast is the first in a series from New Media BC, but just what exactly is New Media? Well, Kelly and I were just talking about some aspects of this, but here's how New Media BC actually defines it, and this is from the website. New Media is the use of new and emerging interactive digital media for the purpose of entertaining, educating, or informing. New Media bridges culture and technology and includes video games, mobile device content, interactive web design, digital film, digital animation, and e-learning. Digital entertainment is the burgeoning intersection between new media and old media, the transition from script to interactive screen, think video games created for movies, interactive web design for mobile phones, and e-learning courses on PDAs. So, let's find out more about what New Media BC actually does from the person who runs New Media BC. I'm with Linda Brown, the president of New Media BC. And Linda, can you give us a thumbnail sketch of what New Media BC actually does?
Sure. New Media BC is the voice for the industry, representing about 800 companies in British Columbia. And what that means is we do whatever we can to grow and support the industry.
So, can you describe like what a typical New Media BC member is? Is it a small company, a big company, or both?
That's a really good question because it's a broad range. We have a lot of small and mid-sized companies in New Media, but we also have really big players like, you know, Radical and Electronic Arts and Blast Radius. But we've got a lot. I would say, you know, at least 50% that are sort of the one, two, three person shop. And what those people need is, it can be quite fundamentally different than what a larger company needs. So we do, in a sense, we do full service support from small to large.
I was going to ask you, what are those companies looking for when they join New Media BC? Is it partly networking? Is it partly advice? Is it peer support? What kinds of things are they asking you about?
Well, that's probably one of our biggest challenges, how to be all things to all people. But if you're working with a small company, generally they're looking at how do they grow their business. So business matchmaking is something we're very much focused on, as well as things like, you know, how do you structure your board? How do you, you know, access financing? What sort of funds are out there? How do you get your product to market? And also, you know, occasionally we'll do missions as well to take small companies. Mid-size is a little bit different. You know, they've grown, they've got some stability. They're looking more for sort of networking, again, business connections, and starting to get, I would say, more political. So looking at the business environment they're in and trying to figure out what they need to grow. And large companies are very, you know, they've got the stability to be very community focused. So they look at, you know, getting involved with our events and sponsoring and outreach to the community and recruiting opportunities. So we cover that whole span, and it will really vary from not only the size of the company, but what subsector they're in New Media.
And what kind of activities and events does New Media, I know you hold tons of events through the course of the year, but what kinds of activities generally are going on with that New Media BC organizes for member companies?
Well, we have the reputation of throwing really good parties, which we don't have any plans to lose that reputation in the future. So, you know, we do member mixers, we do social networking events, but we also do things like, you know, financing forums and roundtables and boot camps and training sessions, and then we'll do things like keynote speeches and breakfast sessions and board of trade events, that sort of thing.
You do things like go down to E3, which is the big game conference every year, where you actually host and help companies go down and present. Those are really big undertakings, right?
Yeah, they are. But it's really important because, you know, with E3, for example, the boot camp that we ran took 8 early stage companies and kind of matched them up with very well established mentors, and then they went down to E3, and you know, it resulted in some very good business for them. So that's the kind of thing we try to do, especially for early stage companies. The later stage or the more established companies benefit from something like a boot camp because they get to see what new talent is out there, what they're working on. There are even some really good partnerships that were formed from that boot camp.
Over the last few years, Vancouver and British Columbia in general has become quite a new media hub, almost quietly behind the scenes. Mm-hmm. Can you talk to me a bit about that? What are you seeing going on in the province?
Well, we're very, very focused right now on establishing Vancouver as a world center for new media. And in my mind, we've really hit the sweet spot, if you will, of that digital entertainment sort of convergence. We've got the third largest production center for film and television in North America. We have the largest hub for new media in Canada, if not North America. Those two things are starting to collide, or are already colliding, in fact, at a fairly rapid pace. So as I look towards the future, if we can be very strategic, and if we can, you know, develop partnerships with the industry, with government, with our community overall, I think we'll have a very good chance of establishing ourselves as truly world leaders in this area.
Can you talk a bit more about what that looks like to you? Like, what does Linda Brown imagine that will be?
You mean apart from world domination?
Yeah.
Right. Well, I think, you know, when I look at 2010, right, and as a province, as a country, we're really focused around that because of the Olympics. So when I look into 2010 and the new media digital entertainment sector here, I see it as absolutely booming. I see it as a new Hollywood, a new Silicon Valley. When you think digital entertainment, you think Vancouver. And what that's going to mean is not only collecting people within a physical location, so having a center or building, but more importantly, that we're all working towards a common strategy and that we've got processes and tools in place that will support companies to get that small company to a mid-size and get the mid-size to launch them into a world, you know, a world market. So I think that's what we're going to see in 2010, and that's definitely what we're focused on right now.
Well, it's interesting too, right, because so many of these companies have, you know, they have deep roots in British Columbia. They're not fly-in businesses that are just taking advantage of either a labor market or tax incentives. They're homegrown companies that have started, as you said, some of them one or two people that are now growing into much larger companies. So, you know, in a way, are you imagining that as they grow, they stay here and spawn other companies?
Absolutely. I mean, one of the things we've got going for us, of course, in BC is an amazing lifestyle. And generally, I think once people get there here, they're reluctant to leave. You know, we also have really smart, creative people here. We have this wonderful sort of organic community, if you will, that is located within a fairly close distance. And we've got pockets of it all over BC. There's some great stuff happening in the Okanagan and on the island, but we're still geographically small enough that people can connect. You know, I think that's going to build upon itself, and as that community grows stronger, there are definitely going to be I don't see that business going elsewhere. I can see that people might set up an office somewhere else or have a presence somewhere else for a business purpose, but generally BC grown, I think, is BC home.
So what kind of devices do you carry around in your everyday life? Like, what are your electronic toys?
You know, I was thinking about that this morning as I had my BlackBerry on the pillow in bed. So I'm very reliant on my BlackBerry. And I don't feel like it's tethered to me. It's actually a tool that really helps me. And it's both my phone and my data device. I also have a pretty new Nano that I haven't fully loaded or figured out yet. But I have a Mini. That's really it. I'm pretty wireless.
And is there any separation between your personal life and your business life, or is it all the same set of tools?
That's a good question. You know, this position, and I mean, I love what I do, but it's very much a what's called a lifestyle position, so you're not really ever off. So those two worlds mix very much for me.
Okay, thanks, Linda.
You're welcome.
Linda Brown from New Media BC. By the way, you can reach them at info@newmediabc.com or www.newmediabc.com. Up next, from Sydney, Australia, Mark Pesce.
You're listening to NMBC.
Mark Pesce is an engineer, a lecturer, an inventor, a digital video artist, and an author. Since the early 1990s, he's been at the forefront of virtual reality modeling, both online and off, and he continues to blend his unique technology, art, and academia into a mix that is quite something else, and he's doing that as a teacher currently in Australia. Mark's on the phone from Sydney. Hi, Mark.
Hi there.
You're at the Australian Film, Television, and Radio School, heading up their interactive media division. What kind of work are people and you doing there?
Well, when I came on board the school 2 years ago, it was what we would think of as pretty much an old-fashioned or old media school, where the school conceived of its product as being reels of film that students would go through the entire production cycle of and then deliver to festivals and maybe, if they were lucky, into commercial distribution. And in the 21st century, that's not really how we think of or how we use media anymore. Media is no longer this thing. It's a stream of bits. It might be living on a computer. It might be projected on a PC. It might be in a digital theater. And what I wanted to do and what I've been able to do is to gradually get them to think much more liberally about what the product of their creative process is. So now we're talking about the deliverables. Yes, they deliver a canister of film, but they'll also deliver a DVD. And when you tell a producer or a director that they're delivering that, then they think about the entire production process of the motion picture differently, because now it's become this digital product. And digital products, we think of them differently. We think of them as being mutable, as being copyable, as being more interactive, all these different qualities. Now, if you talk to a sound editor or to a film editor, that's how they've been dealing with film for 10 years already. So really, working toward is to get the producers and the directors at the school to sort of enter the modern age where the post-production people have already been.
This really reminds me of the shift from linear editing to digital editing, when they started to think about how they could lift out slices of that product. And it took a real, you know, it took a real long time for people to start thinking in that way. And what I'm hearing you talk about now is looking at content in exactly the same way.
Yeah, exactly. When the nonlinear editing systems came online in the early 90s through the mid-90s, there was an entire revolution in editing. And it took some time for the editors to be able to come to grips with it, and then also to be able to translate that into a language that the director could understand, so that directing now has been influenced by the freedom that the editor has in the edit suite. Well, now I'm trying to get the producers to think about that freedom as well, so that when a film production goes into production, I tell the producer that they're now in this incredible time where they're just building up all of this intellectual asset, intellectual property, that everything that goes on during the production process, not just the 2 hours that might end up in a film canister at the end, but the entire production process is generating intellectual property and generating intellectual capital at an enormous clip, and the producer has to think about grabbing that and saving that and using it. One of the big reasons is because unless you're an American big film studio production, your production probably doesn't have a lot of money behind it. Your investors are taking a big gamble, and so the more opportunities that you can to create intellectual property as a part of the whole production process, the better chance you have of being able to pay off your investors and being able to go on to make your next movie.
This sounds a lot like, and correct me if I'm wrong, but it sounds a lot to me like what Peter Jackson's doing next door in New Zealand with his production.
Peter Jackson is the textbook example of how to do this. The interesting thing is that Peter Jackson won the Best Picture Award 2 years ago. That goes to a producer, not to a director. He got it because he basically taught Hollywood an entirely new methodology for how to deal with the production process in the context of creating intellectual properties. Now, because he was dealing with a very well-known property, Lord of the Rings, and because he had the full resources of Warner Brothers behind him, he could take that into a lot of different dimensions. And it's reckoned now that by the time that Warner completely amortizes all of the profit from Lord of the Rings, from the three movies, that'll come to close to $30 billion.
Unbelievable, eh? That's just phenomenal.
Absolutely unbelievable.
Now, I want to switch gears a bit. There's two Canadians that have played quite a major role in your work. One of them is the late Marshall McLuhan, the other writer William Gibson, who lives here in British Columbia. How did they influence you?
Well, and McLuhan's influence is fundamental. There are a couple of influences on my thought which are completely fundamental. You have named two of them. The interesting thing about McLuhan is that he has an approach to media which allows us to step outside of actually just viewing the medium itself, viewing the television program, and it allows us to take a look at the device. All devices that we use shape the way we think about what's coming out of that device. That's the medium is the message, right? That's the foundation of McLuhan's thought, which tossed around a lot in the 60s, and we seem to have, in a lot of ways, forgotten about it. I'll give you an example from my current work. I'm really intensely looking at the mobile phone right now. Now, in North America, the mobile phone is mostly a device for voice communication. In Australia, the mobile phone is mostly a device for text communication. People send text messages. That's the way it is in Asia. That's the way it is in Europe. That's the way it is in Australia. And so a lot of what we're doing with the device is contingent, particularly in North America, with its history as a telephone. Well, if we take ourselves out of that and say, okay, well, this is a generic device for communication, it's a device for communicating with other people, how can we look at what this device is capable of in a way that enhances that communication, puts that communication first and foremost? Because all the different ways of communicating, whether it's communicating via voice, communicating via text, or something else, those are side effects of the fact that this thing is about communication. Now, that said, there are different kinds of communication. McLuhan talked about the telephone as the most personal of all technologies because someone is speaking directly into your ear. It's extremely intimate. It's like a lover. And so all the qualities that we associate with the telephone are bound up in that relationship. But if we take a look at text is very much, it's a different medium. It's abstract. You look at it, you read it, you use your eyes in a different way. And it emphasizes another kind of communication. Just recently, a study came out showing that email communication has a lot in common with the old style of letter writing. People used to write hundreds of letters before there were really strong electronic communication systems. People would write hundreds of letters a year in great detail and keeping up their personal correspondence with how they kept their social network strong and growing. And we're starting to see the same thing now showing up in electronic mail, so that there are certain elements of the medium and the reasons for using the medium that remain across it.
And just on that thread of the text and the long letter writing, I mean, blogging, I guess, is sort of a reflection of that as well.
Blogging is certainly comes out of that. I think the blogging is actually really interesting. We want to sort of make a difference between, there are two basic kinds of blogging that are going on in the world. There is diuretic blogging. People are sort of just making notes about their life. And the comment portion of a blog, where people come in and say things, is less important in that diuretic type of blogging. Mm. The type of blogging that I'm really interested in now is conversational blogging, where someone will pose something. It's a question, it's a statement, it's a thesis, it's a random thought that occurred to them. And what they're doing is they're doing their best to encourage a swarm of people to come in and contribute to that. It becomes a stone soup where everyone's throwing in the best that they can offer. And what people are looking for in that sort of conversational blogging framework is they're looking for understanding. Mm-hmm. And it's a different process than diuretic blogging, and it's a different outcome than diuretic blogging. And I think that's the kind of blogging that is right now transforming the world. We've had diuretic blogging really since the first days of the web, because the difference between a diuretic blog and someone putting up a page in 1995 about the cats that they like isn't that great. But this idea of having a conversation around an issue and really encouraging a swarm of individuals to contribute to some sort of common intelligence, some collective intelligence, and Derek DeKirk of the University of Toronto really got me into this back about 10 years ago. Mm. That kind of production of collective intelligence is going to change the way we work.
And you're seeing its influence, you know, in mainstream journalism now as well. I just think that's quite powerful what it's doing to the kind of psyche of the public as they realize that their voice will be heard and that those comments will be paid attention to.
Yes, and the next level up from that, though, is now the entire profession of journalism is starting to have a discussion within itself about its relevance. And that's happening alongside another discussion that's happening in the blogosphere and also in the wikisphere about ascertaining truth. Wikipedia, which is something that is an enormous research interest for me right now, is a collective encyclopedia. Anyone can come in and use it. Anyone can come in and edit it. Anyone can come in and just add to it, add new subjects to it. It's now become the 14th most popular site on the internet over the course of about the last 3 years as it's been building. And the biggest issue Wikipedia is facing now is not getting enough content in there, because there are already over 800,000 English language articles, which is about four times the number in the Encyclopedia Britannica. It's not that that's a problem anymore. What the problem now is that there's a quality issue, that people can go to a page, say, on Jane Fonda or Bill Gates and find out that it's just filled with inaccuracies. You might be able to find out something about Elizabeth I, which is basically a very high-quality academic article. But if you go off the map into other areas where people have spent less time, the information has less quality, less truthful quality associated with it. Yet Wikipedia doesn't have any way to be able to tell you that this information may be used as trustworthy as another page. So people are now entertaining the idea of how to build systems that allow you to do that. The same thing's going on in the blogosphere, where people can put out the most outrageous libels and outrageous slanders, and yet they'll get passed on as truth over and over and over again. And so that's a large issue that journalism is dealing about, because journalism is also facing the same credibility issues. We only take a look recently at Judith Miller and her involvement in the Plumgate affair. All of that's happening, and it's all dealing with the same issues, but in slightly different focuses.
Right. Now, I took you off track there. You were just about to switch over to William Gibson and his influence on your work, and I'm assuming that was more in the Vermeil space.
Right. Again, I mean, this is the man who coined the word cyberspace. When I read Burning Chrome, which was, I think, just after it was published, which was the story that's sort of a precursor to the world of Neuromancer, and this was in 1992, I think it was published, he set the stage for the world that we're living in. And it's interesting because his most recent book, which I think is next to Neuromancer, really his finest work, which is Pattern Recognition, is set in 2002. He stopped writing science fiction and started writing stories for the present, but he didn't lose any of the sense of mystery or magic that pervades his earlier work. Why? Because his influence on the world has been so profound that the world essentially became Gibsonian. He didn't have to change anything in his style or in his approach to his subject matter to get the same quality of the present about it. All right. So I read Gibson in 1980. I read Neuromancer, I think, in 1990, actually. Yeah. 1989, 1990. And I started to understand that this internet, which I'd already been working on as an engineer for a few years, was best approached if we thought about it as a space. That there are certain kinds of things that if you could place them around you in a space would be much easier to handle and organize. And this is something that is so far ahead of its time that even when virtual reality exploded in the early 90s, it was too abstract, it was too rich for people. And so virtual reality, for a number of reasons, caught on as a very popular idea, and although the basic ideas of virtual reality are now completely pervasive in terms of all the video games that are out there in the world, which create their own virtual realities. Because of all of that, Gibson's ideas have gone everywhere, but we haven't been using them as sort of day-to-day life to sort of manage all the influx of our email, manage all the links to media that people are sending us. That's where it's going to go now. We're going to start to use 3D because it's simply a more effective way of organizing the avalanche of information that we're situated in.
Yeah, and I think when you talk about McLuhan and the devices and how we've seemed to have lost track of that, and it's become so much more important now as these devices start to show up in our lives, and I'm going to ask you in a minute about the kind of devices you're carrying around and the stuff that Gibson was talking about. And then the other guy is Negroponte, who was at MIT, and you know, we talked about nonlinear editing earlier, and he was certainly involved with that work early on at MIT. But he also talked about the notion of the bits passing by and you grabbing them and using the ones you needed. And you know, we're still really far away from that. We're still flooded with all sorts of bits that we don't want, and we don't know how to manage them yet.
Yeah, well, and that's the interesting thing about this is we've entered, I think, if there's a second level of revolution, people are talking about Web 2.0 right now, and everyone's very excited and yet being a little bit afraid of the hyperbole because of the dot-com implosion back a few years ago. The Web 2.0 revolution is not a revolution in infrastructure, all right? We have now fiber everywhere we want to go. I'm making a phone call to you from halfway around the world, and we don't think anything about it. We could be using Skype right now and making that call for free if we wanted to. Well, all right?
We actually are using voice over IP.
Well, then even better, okay? So we're actually sending this entire call through the internet, so on and so forth. And so all of these pieces are fundamentally in place. It's not about infrastructure anymore. It's about interface now. That's what this revolution is all about. That's what I'm teaching my design students. Because I don't only work with the filmmakers, but I have a cadre of students who specifically work on these issues. We can pretty much do anything we want now in the domain of electronic communication. What's important now is figuring out what we want to do. What that's being driven by is the informational pressure that this connectivity, that the infrastructure is placing on us. Because once we got the connectivity, it was inevitable that the connectivity was going to be used. So we do. We have this onrush of emails. We have this onrush of websites. We have this onrush of video. I don't have time now to watch all of the media that I can possibly download or that friends are sending to me. We need now to build systems that allow us to segregate that, to manage that, to prioritize that, and those systems need to be invisible. They need to be doing most of the work for us. We need to maintain them in the same way that you might enter your physical mailbox every couple of days. But we need them to be as seamlessly integrated into the flow and fabric of our lives as possible, and that's much more of an interface issue than it has anything to do with infrastructure. Exactly. We take a look at Delicious, which is one of the coolest things ever. And it's a social bookmark tool so that I can make bookmarks and then share them with people who subscribe to my bookmarks. So my graduate student and I share our bookmarks because we're both generally doing the same kinds of research. But I also look at Clay Shirky. Clay Shirky is one of the brightest people around when it comes to this understanding of the interface in the information era. And so I have a view into their heads. I have a view into their what they're thinking is, what they feel is important. Now, Delicious is, it's becoming very popular, but it is, I think, of all the websites that I've used in the last 5 years, it is the ugliest and the most unfriendly of the lot. And yet it's enormously popular because it's serving a need. And but it's coming from the mind of, I think, it's a 22-year-old who sits in a cafe most days, you know, with his laptop in hand, coding away and building out this beautiful idea of his. His idea is impeccable. His implementation as far as the interface works, not so good. But he's gotten so many people interested in it that there are a swarm of people helping him. We're about to see the launch of Flock, which is a new browser that's based on Firefox.
Right.
Flock integrates Delicious functionality into it, so you don't have to do anything hard. It sort of takes all the interface that makes it difficult and makes it easy to use again. We're going to see so many things like this over the next 5 years that I think arguably the way we're going to be using the web 5 years from now is going to be nearly unrecognizable to the way we use it today.
Yeah, I would agree with you. And there's a young guy here in Vancouver named Chris Krug. He's been really talking about this in a way that most people can understand. And his starting position is, you know, the website is dead. It's all about, you know, finding you, whether it's through Google or Delicious or Technorati.
The website isn't so much dead as it is the end point. You're done. When you hit the website, you're done. Right? You've reached the end of the tree, and it's always much more important now to be able to sort of move through that tree really seamlessly, really quickly, and with a lot of purpose behind you. And so I think that's what this Web 2.0 generation, this Web 2.0 swarm is all about. It's about, okay, 10 years ago when we built the web, the swarm, the activity of the swarm of people involved were specifically just building the web. Well, now the web's built. We've got 8 billion and counting pages. Okay, the web's built. Oh, my God, how do we deal with 8 billion pages? That's what this is all about.
So, Mark, what kind of devices are you carrying around with you in your everyday life here?
The most important devices I carry around is I carry around a 12-inch iBook because it's a tiny computer and it's a Macintosh, which means it's just unbelievably wonderful. But it's small enough that I can carry it with me everywhere, and it really does come with me almost everywhere. I have an iPod, a 60-gigabyte iPod, because I need it with my entire music collection, and I keep about 7,000 songs on the iPod, and they're just always with me everywhere. And then I just bought a brand new Sony Ericsson 750i mobile phone. And the reason I got that, I had a Sony before this, it's a very full-featured phone. It has a lot of flash memory inside of it. It stores a gigabyte, but it's also programmable in Java. And for me, as someone who does write a lot of code and who wants to be able to take a device with some very common usages and then pervert those usages to my own end, having a phone that I can write programs for that do very interesting things is a really big kick for me, because then I can say, oh, well, yeah, this is a phone, but wait, look what I just needed to do in order to not just talk up a point, but actually be able to prove the point. Because oftentimes, particularly when you're dealing with weird technologies, you have to show people. You can't just say, wouldn't it be great if, that's not enough to inspire people. You actually have to be able to hand them this, get them to use this. And so I've taken this phone device, which really most people just think of as something you make calls and maybe text messages on, and made it this not this general purpose, but made it this communication portal that I'm carrying around with me that I can then convert and pervert to my own end.
And do you have a game platform that you're using, or?
It's really funny because I do teach my students about games, and I have a PSP, I should mention now. I bought a PSP when it came out, but I bought it mostly for its use as a media platform, so that I could watch movies, I use the torrent a lot to grab television shows, and then I put them on the PSP so I can watch them somewhere else, because the screen is beautiful and it works very well. My problem is I've been programming for such a long time, for well over 25 years now, that to me the ultimate computer game is to write a program for the computer. And it's always been that way. Now, I do occasionally play computer games, but most of the time that I'm sort of fighting a computer in a computer game and trying to master it, there's this nagging voice in the back of my head saying, a better use of my mental energy or my play energy is to play with a computer and write a program. Because for me, that aspect of engineering has always been very much influenced from my desire to play. It's not about work.
I gotcha. So, last question. When you're traveling and you haul out your passport, what do you tell people you do? I mean, you've got so many titles and you've done so many things.
Mad scientist? No. I mean, it's always very hard with that because there's so many different areas. I think most of us are moving in that direction. I'm driven by my passions, and my passions are often around taking something and transforming people's expectations of it, whether it's a field of inquiry, whether it's a device, it doesn't matter. I mean, my idea of playing is to be able to do those interventions, those transformations, and then get them out there and let people play with them, because I think that to me is the most important thing. And, I mean, I guess that's the kind of good, bad scientist role, is to take things and then surprise people and shock them and to get them to think about things differently.
Well, thank you, Mr. Mad Scientist in Sydney, Mark Pesce. Very nice talking to you, and hopefully we'll meet you in Vancouver soon.
Thank you very much.
Mark Pesce in Sydney, Australia. Oh, that social bookmarking site Mark mentioned, Delicious. The URL is del.ico.us. Thanks a lot for listening, and thanks to our guests, Kelly Zamak at Radical Entertainment, Linda Brown of New Media BC, and Mark Pesce. You can email us, info@newmediabc.com, and if you want to reach any of our guests, we'd be happy to pass your email along. Subscribe to our podcasts at feeds.feedburner.com/NMBC. That's feeds.feedburner.com/NMBC. Many thanks to Kirsten and Linda and to Garnet for that ID. New Media BC on the web is www.newmediabc.com. This podcast was produced by New Media BC and At Large Media in Vancouver. I'm Robert Wiemann.
I am Evil Homer.
You're listening to NMBC.
Edit.